London is a busy place. It's always been a busy place. It's always been a thriving, crowded city filled with people and life and events. It's the kind of place where it follows the beat of its own drum and can be seen as a world unto itself. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to the chronological story of the city throughout history. In the story so far, we've reached round about the year 1415, and the aftermath of that great victory of the English king, Henry V, at the Battle of Agincourt, and also the sudden dramatic rebellion of the Lollards of London and their attempt to kill him. In a few years' time, the city will try and regulate its sex trade, which was something we covered last chapter in some detail. But around these events, both before and after, London was busy. It was a city facing serious economic decline, where the numbers of the middling sort of people, you know, not too rich or too poor, began to grow, as did the numbers of people in abject poverty, while the rich, who could use their wealth to hold political power, actually shrank in number. And the principal cause of this was that England was at war, with the constant need for cash from the state to fund armies and to get supplies over to forces fighting in France, and this was an endless drain upon the economy. During the few years covered in this chapter, we will tell the story of London as it tries to go about its daily life with this in the background. And we have a story of criminals, building projects, slander, regulations, and more. Welcome then to the 151st chapter of this story of London, one utterly focused on life on its streets, where wider geopolitical issues are ignored as we get lost in the crowded minutiae of this amazing place. Welcome then to the affairs of the city. London's a kind of place where the geography is always changing, and in 1415 we saw changes being made in the walls, as one of the exits through the city was expanded. The Moorgate was, surprisingly enough, before 1415, merely a postern gate, aka a small pedestrian one not wide enough to take carts, apparently. It was only in 1415 that it was enlarged into a proper gate. And why did they expand it? Well, reports at the time described the moor on the other side of the Moorgate as being polluted by a common latrine, which so overflowed that the nearby residences were affected by, quote, many sicknesses and other intolerable maladies arising from the horrible, corrupt and infected atmosphere, unquote. Oh, well, there you go. Apparently, Moorgate was a shithole. I'm not saying about the contemporary state of the place. As well as the gate being expanded, it was decided to improve life on the other side, and it was ordered that the moor should be divided into gardens and cultivated, and the latrines should be done away with. South of London, on March 3rd of 1415, a convent was founded down in Twickenham. This establishment was the only house of the Brigantine Order of Nuns, which was formed and named after a member of the Swedish royal family who decided to take holy orders. An English diplomat called Sir Henry Fitzhugh donated his manor house in Cambridgeshire to found an English house of that order. However, back in 1408, Parliament had forbidden the establishment of any foreign-based holy priories. And Henry V, who kind of needed to ingratiate himself with one of the popes at the time, there were several, had to find his way round the situation. He decided he would make the house at Twickenham as the first house of a new English order. And indeed, he went further by endowing it with lands he'd taken from foreign priories in the years previously. The foundation charter provided that this nunnery should be composed of an abbess and 59 nuns, who were living in the same place as 25 religious men, of whom 13 were to be priests. The sexes were supposedly strictly segregated and lived in separate courts, but they did share a common church. It sounds like a good idea. It turned out to be a crap one. Within 10 years, it was discovered the buildings were inadequate and the site was utterly unhealthy. The convent eventually moved to Arlesworth in 1431. 1415 is a year we see a very elaborate case of theft in London. A mercer called William Bury, who had a shop in the parish of St. Pancras, was taken in an elaborate long con instigated by someone called Thomas de Albertus, it seems. See, de Albertus had sent a confederate of his called Michael Pentine, who was not from London, to Bury's shop, claiming, quote, he wanted to get certain cloths of gold for the use of our lord, the Duke of Bourbon, unquote. Michael Pentine was offering to spend some big money. Quote, and the said William there and then showed the same Michael such cloths as he required. Whereupon he chose 4 cloths of gold, 150 shillings in value. After which, when the said Michael had agreed with the same William Bury as to the price thereof, he said that if he would send with him one of his servants, together with the cloths, to the dwelling house of said Thomas de Albertus in the parish of St. Swithin in London, for the purpose of showing the cloths to said Thomas, immediate payment would be then made, unquote. It sounds pretty good. So William Bury, quote, sent one John Cherkey, his servant, with him to the dwelling house of Thomas de Albertus, together with the cloths aforesaid, to show them to the said Thomas. But in the meantime, the said Thomas, to fulfil and carry out his malice and deceit, withdrew himself, while the same Michael Pentine and John Cherkey, the servant, were on their way thither. And upon coming there, Thomas de Albertus not being in the house, the said Michael ordered John Cherkey to leave the cloths there in the house of said Thomas, and said that when he came home he would pay him for sure. Upon which the said John Cherkey, putting faith in the words of the said Michael, left the said cloths and departed. Unquote. So, as cons go, it's actually pretty simple, because what immediately happened was Michael Pentine then left carrying this expensive cloth. He then met Thomas de Albertus somewhere else, handed over this 150 shillings worth of expensive cloth, and then took his agreed cut for this part of the robbery. And then Michael Pentine stuck himself in a church, to be precise, the, quote, house of the minoresses without Aldgate, unquote. And once there, he did claim sanctuary for his crimes. Meanwhile, Michael de Albertus, well, he could sell the material for profit and said he knew nothing about it. He wasn't even in the house. Who is this Michael Pentine? Me? I'm innocent, mate. I know nothing. It's a great week on. However, Mayor Wootton and the Aldermen of London were having none of it. Thomas de Albertus was arrested for being behind the whole thing and jailed, and the case was brought before the mayor and his chosen jury on December 7th that year. And they, well, quote, upon their oath pronounced the said Thomas guilty of deceit and falsity aforesaid. Therefore, in order that other persons might beware in future of such falsities and deceits, it was adjudged by the court that the said Thomas should be put upon a pillory on 3 market days for 1 hour each day, and that the cause thereof should be proclaimed, unquote. Yep, Thomas de Albertus was punished to public shaming. However, he did seem to have friends in high places. Quote, afterwards, at the insistence of very many reputable merchants interceding on behalf of the said Thomas, execution of the judgment aforesaid was remitted to him for £20, which he, the said Thomas, paid towards the new work of the Guildhall for his redemption in this behalf, unquote. So, yeah, Thomas de Albertus managed to get out by bunging the mayor £20 towards the rebuilding of the Guildhall, and gets away without the public humiliation. Nice try, Thomas, but you got caught out. By 1416, affairs of state were beginning to impact upon London. By the start of March, there was held in London and Westminster a parliament and a convention of the clergy, and the principal purpose of these seems to be raising a lot of cash for the war economy of the king. And then the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund arrived in London. Emperor Sigismund had turned up in England on the 1st of May in an attempt to mediate the war between Henry V and the French. He was met by the great and the good at Blackheath and then was installed to live in the Palace of Westminster. Henry V himself moved out of Westminster and took over the Archbishop of Canterbury's house nearby in Lambeth. And the reason why he moved out is because apparently Sigismund turned up with hundreds, if not 1,000 of his own nobles. This was a grand state visit. Sigismund was invested as a Knight of the Garter up at Windsor Castle. Now, officiating this ceremony was the first Garter Knight of Arms, a man called Sir Walter Bruges. And he later got the honour of entertaining the Emperor at his house over in Kentish Town. Now, we don't know how many attended this banquet halfway up today's St. Pancras Way, but we do have some indication of the sheer size of it. In the procession, the guests came from the Bishop of Ely's palace in Holborn, and they were headed by the, quote, crafts of London standing in their liveries in places accustomed, unquote. After all the livery companies had marched down to Kentish Town, they were followed by soldiers, and then the mayor and his brethren, then the king's trumpeters, then all the officers at arms, then various gentlemen and esquires in blue and gold, then the Bishop of Ely himself on a, quote, palfrey in white and gold, unquote, and then came the foreigners. You had the Duke of Brega, the Prince of Hungary, the Duke of Holland, and finally the Holy Roman Emperor himself. It's a hell of an event to be held in a relatively small house in a village outside London. The story goes that Sir William met the procession, knelt bareheaded before its numbers, and then led them to his house, where the guests were entertained by a score of minstrels. An idea of the size of what followed is that we know from the inventory that that meal included 9 pigs, 7 sheep, 100 pullets, 100 pigeons, 30 capons and 20 hens, plus a range of hares, rabbits, salmon, eels, crabs, oysters, and massive pies made of venison, boar and lamprey. That one feast's food bill came to the enormous sum of £193, and we're not even including the cost of the wine. Thomas of Usk reported, however, that the visit of the emperor gained little, and, quote, after he had abode in London at the great cost of the realm, the business being thwarted by the cunning of the French, he returned again to the Council of Constance, unquote. Yep, the Holy Roman Emperor turned up, got nowhere, and nicely pissed off. The war with France carried on. That year, Thomas of Usk tells us that, quote, a dreadful battle at sea was fought under the Duke of Bedford, the king's brother, against the French, of whom many were brought captive with their ships into England, but their store of victuals was sent into Harfleur, unquote. And yeah, the state of the garrison of Harfleur was the cause of some concern for the king. And across London that year, a proclamation was made by the king soon after, which said, quote, By this proclamation made, all manner of men, merchant, artificers, and others, of what estate, degree, and condition they may be in, that we will you towards our lord the king, being at Harfleur on the coast of Normandy, that to God him speed any corn, bread, meal, or flour, wine, ale, or fish, flesh, or any other victual, clothes, linen, woolen, or any merchandise, breeches, doublets, hosen, shoes, or any other manner of armour, artillery, or of any other stuff, unquote. Over the next few years, we're going to see several proclamations along the same line. Supplying Harfleur, and by extension the war in France, was to be a constant source of pleas, orders and commands, as the king required more and more resources to keep his war in Normandy and northern France going. And of course, because of this, there was plenty of opportunities for criminals in London to thrive. we see a man called William Redhey of Barnet, who, quote, falsely and fraudulently pretended that he was an officer of our Lord the King, saying and affirming that he was the taker and purveyor of such victuals, as well as for the household of our said Lord the King, for the victualling of his town of Harfleur, and so, under feigned colour of his alleged office, he would have had wheat aforesaid taken and carried away, had he not been warily prevented from doing so by the constables and reputable men of the parish aforesaid, unquote. This was to be a background detail to all that's happening in London, which kind of shrugged, offered what it could to the garrison at Harfleur, and then carried on with its own rules and life. One rule in the city at the time, apparently, no one could be the member of two livery companies. Well, certain merchanting enterprises would see men of various livery companies working together, you could only ever formally be part of one of the guilds of London. And that probably explains why, in this era, we see the urgent case of a man called Richard Merlo, one of the aldermen of the city. Apparently Merlo was, quote, first admitted to the freedom of the city in the crafts of the ironmongers, unquote. And he served as an ironmonger for a while, but then, quote, as well the trade of fishmongers as of the ironmongers in the city aforesaid, and had received yearly and at different times liveries or vestments from the same trades, unquote. This double booking, ironmonger and fishmonger, especially for an alderman, was apparently absolutely unacceptable. And so on, quote, the 10th day of the month of March, together with many other good and sufficient men from the trade of fishmongers aforesaid, came before Nicholas Wotton, the mayor and the alderman, in the chamber of the Guildhall of London, and entreat them with all due urgency. They should decide to admit him, the said Richard, to the freedom and the vestige or livery of the trade of fishmongers aforesaid, unquote. It was agreed upon, but it shows just how difficult and serious changing your livery companies was back then. There were other rules at the time, and for example, apprentices were actually forbidden from going, this job I'm doing is shit, and quitting. Mayor Wotton heard a case that July wherein a man called Robert Arnold came to him, complaining that, quote, William Brockley, son of the late John Brockley of Delbury in the county of Salop, on the 28th day of March in the 12th year of the reign of the late King Henry, had put himself apprentice to the aforesaid Robert, and who, on behalf of the said Robert, his master, had heretofore been on business for trading in diverse parts, as well as on this side of the sea as beyond, unquote. Yep, it does seem that William Brockley had been an apprentice who had served Robert Arnold for some years, and as such, he'd travelled abroad doing business. But recently, he, quote, had of late, without leave and without reasonable cause, unlawfully withdrawn himself from the service of his master and departed, to the no small loss and grievance of his said master. And whereas the said Robert feared that he might very possibly be damnedified by the same William, if he should appear under the feigned colour of being the factor and attorney of his said master, while so living at large, as he might in the name of such master receive diverse quantities of things and merchandises, and various sums of money. Therefore, on the 4th of July, the said Robert Arnold came here before the mayor, and in full court repudiated and renounced whatever the same apprentice should have done as being a factor and attorney from the time that he so withdrew himself and departed, unquote. Yeah, you can see why this was a rule. Apprentices could be set abroad, and when they turned up abroad, they could say, I represent my master, give me these goods or lend me these monies, and he will redeem them. If you were no longer his apprentice, you could make the claim and then, you know, piss off somewhere and the master would have to pay for it. They could run up substantial debts, hence why you had William Brockley being condemned by Robert Arnold as Robert was covering his back. London at this time comes across as a place busy with passion and unspoken grievances. One example, we see in 1416 a statement being issued that year that said, quote, I, John Russell, citizen and woolpacker of London, acknowledge here in this present court before the worshipful estates of the mayor and the aldermen that I spake and noised in diverse places of London diverse words and matters scandalous of Thomas Falconer, now alderman of late mayor of London, of diverse things which he should have done in his office as mayor, unquote. What had John Russell said that had him up in court and making such apologies? Well, it all to do with the crushing of the Lollards. If you remember a couple of episodes ago, I mentioned the claim I got from another historian that Thomas Falconer, as mayor, had decided to burn Richard Gurmin, a baker, for the crime of heresy. But that when he burnt him, Gurmin was carrying letters patent that forgave him for any previous crimes. Falconer had apparently burned this royal pardon along with him, and this is why he ended up in the Tower of London and had to pay a fine. The problem is, it transpires that this John Russell either embellished this story so much or potentially made this story up that Thomas Falconer, quote, asked for redress, and that the said John Russell might be chastised, according to the custom of the said city hitherto prevailing and approved in the same, to the end that such liars and detractors might fear in future to slander undeservedly any reputable persons, unquote. So yeah, Falconer sued Russell for embellishing or lying about what actually happened with the burning of Richard Gurmin. The case turned into a bit of a saga. Russell had several friends who vouchsafed his innocence and stood surety for the bail for him, which was set at £100. But as the case came closer to trial, Russell panicked and fled to Westminster Abbey and sought sanctuary there. He remained in the Abbey for about 9 months, and during said time, the city's authorities turned to his friends and demanded the £100 they offered as bail. They then ended up appearing at the courts begging for mercy, as they were poor men. But they were not listened to and had their goods seized, and eventually Russell, feeling very sorry for himself, gave himself up and confessed and made that statement I mentioned earlier before adding, quote, "Where off I now, meekly and as lowly as I can or may, I ask and beseech the aforesaid Thomas Falconer for forgiveness of that I have offended," unquote. Yeah, you had to be careful about who you slagged off, especially the rich with big legal pockets. Mayor Wotton was a zealous mayor, and invigorated by the regime of Henry V, he seemed to be all about reforming the city to make it run smoother. And one issue he faced was something we mentioned a few chapters ago. There was a lack of men able and willing to afford to take the burden of becoming mayor or sheriff or even alderman of London. The political class was becoming limited, and indeed many were trying hard to avoid service as leaders of London, maybe because it ended up costing you. And we get an illustration of how bad this problem became. In a proclamation the mayor and the aldermen issued this year, which said, quote, "For as much as it is not consonant with reason, that those who for their own purposes dwell within a city and there enjoy many advantages in doing so, should refuse the charge of offices of such a city when they devolve upon them, as it is the fact that many citizens of the city of London, who are blessed with affluence and sufficiency of property and means, do not fear at present to infringe upon the good peace and concord of the city. At the present day, a thing to be lamented, some who are citizens thereof, although themselves deemed worthy to bear the offices aforesaid, do diligently go round to many other citizens and other persons in said city, and influence them, and prevail upon them to come to the Guildhall, together with their apprentices and serving men, and there, collecting a great crowd, to shout and make an uproar to the effect that such or such a one must be mayor or sheriff, about whom perhaps there has been but little or no mention made before, it being their own end and object that by the prevalence of such shouting they may gain exemption from such offices for themselves, unquote. Yep, here we are seeing the mayor reporting that there are political campaigns involving rich people drumming up mobs of Londoners. But rather than choosing themselves to become sheriffs of mayor for their political purposes, they wanted them to pick some other poor sod so that they didn't have to do it. They were gathering violent mobs to get themselves off the hook. And the mayor was tolerating none of this. Quote, by reason of which crowding also and division into parties, various dissensions and contumelies are daily occurring and arising, and to a much greater extent in future will arise, unless there be a speedy stop put thereto. In consequence whereof, not only the general peace of the people dwelling in the said city and the true and free election of the mayor and the sheriffs have been oft times disturbed, but also sudden destruction, it is feared, will overtake the same people, a thing that must result in still greater mischief. Therefore, on Thursday, the 24th of September, Nicholas Wotton, now mayor, and the aldermen, with the assent and consent of very many of the more reputable and more sufficient men of the said city, for the augmenting the quietude of the said city, have ordained and established that no one of said city in the future, upon whom the election of the office of mayor or sheriff is likely to fall, shall form any parties or hold any meetings for the purpose of avoiding such office. This under a penalty of £100, unquote. Yep, London took serious steps to make sure that no one could avoid taking office in the future. But while such matters are all about the city running itself, there were more serious and deadly matters that came before the mayor that year. For all the rejoicing about the victory in Agincourt, it is worth remembering that a bunch of religious fanatics had tried to kill the king only a few years earlier, and there were well-developed plots to assassinate him from within the nobility and more. We have to keep in mind that the king's father had usurped a throne, and there were some who still hankered for the old regime. 1416 saw one such case. And Mayor Wotton that September presided over that case, which was heard in Newgate Prison, regarding a man called Benedict Woolman. Quote, Hostilia, late under Marshal of the Marshalsea of the Household of Our Lord the King, and Thomas Birkin of Birkin in the County of Lincoln, gentlemen, unquote. Now, their crime that had put them in jail in the first place, quote, on the 18th day of April, at London, in the parish of St. Dunstan West in Fleet Street, in the ward of Farndon Without, falsely and traitorously compassing and imagining the death of our Lord the King against their allegiance, did internally and confederate together, and in order to bring Thomas Ward, who they asserted to be King Richard, late King of England, from the Kingdom of Scotland into the Kingdom of England, with the intent and purpose to depose our Lord the King, now reigning, from the estate of his royalty, and to disinherit him and his heirs from the realm of England aforesaid, unquote. Yeah, these guys claimed that this guy called Thomas Ward in Scotland was actually King Richard II alive and well. There then follows an elaborate plot where they actually approach the Holy Roman Emperor and sent him a petition and asked the Holy Roman Emperor if he would, you know, topple Henry V so the rightful king should come from Scotland. Yeah, the Holy Roman Emperor, by the way, when he got these documents, read them and then passed them straight over to the king's people. This had caused the authorities to arrest the two men and a couple of accomplices. All of these men were then bungled into Newgate Prison. And while the trial was ongoing, John Birkin died, quote, died in the prison of Newgate of his rightful death, unquote. Yeah, so the conditions were so bad that one of the suspects actually died, and we'll come back to the conditions in Newgate before the end. But the trial of his main co-conspirator carried on, and the jury, quote, upon their oath pronounced the said Benedict guilty of treason aforesaid, unquote. Benedict Woolman, who sounds somewhat delusional, was then sentenced that he, quote, should be taken from the jail aforesaid to the tower of said city, and from thence drawn through the middle of the city in the high streets of Cornhill and Westcheap to the gallows at Tyburn, there to be hanged and beheaded, his head to be sat upon London Bridge, unquote. London was clearly closing up shop against traitors, and perhaps that's why they finally caught up with the main Londoner involved in the Lollard uprising, William Patchmaker, in October that year. His case was brief, the facts of the failed uprising testified to and agreed upon, and he was also sentenced, taken through the streets of London to the gallows at Tyburn, and there to be hanged and beheaded. And indeed, by 1417, Sir John Oldcastle himself was finally caught up with his race run, and the leader of the Lollard insurrection was finally captured and brought to London in January of that year. The way Thomas of Usk describes it, quote, Sir John Oldcastle, the heretic, renouncing the sacrament of the altar, the Blessed Virgin, and confession, and eager to pervert the king and the kingdom, after a long exile in Powys, was captured by the lord of that county, and on the 14th day of December, he was hung on the gallows in a chain of iron. And after that had been drawn, and once and for all was burnt up with a fierce fire bestowed, paying justly the penalty of both swords, unquote. Yeah, Oldcastle was hung from the gallows by chains, and we don't think they actually choked him. It was just a painful way to hang the man, and then they lit a fire underneath him. Ouch. But in between such weighty measures, you still have mundane crimes going on, like the two wives of a couple of poultry dealers called Mr. Hilder and John Mead. The two women were alleged to have overcharged a customer for woodcocks and partridges and had been thrown in jail briefly. And afterwards, quote, the wife of Hilde and the wife of Mead were released from prison. They were enjoined that in future they should sell their fowl according to the assize on pain of imprisonment, from which without great chastisement they should not escape, unquote. And you also had the city actually doing a stock check of all the wine supposedly to be found on sale in the place. On the 7th of December, 1416, quote, on this day came searchers of wine, and made presentment that they had found within the city, on the east side of white and red wine, 154 tons, and on the west side of said city, 124 tons. And they presented the following unsound wines, mainly in the dwelling house of William Culver in Lumber Street, one pipe of red wine, in the dwelling house of Tom and Sidmund in the same street, one pipe of red wine, in the dwelling house of Chorlton in Friday Street, one pipe of red wine, at the corner of St. Magnus at Le Couron, one pipe of red wine. And they presented off sweet wines on the east side of the city, 587 butts, and on the west side of the city, 113 butts back then. Yep, honestly, back in 1416, London could and did keep track of all the booze, good and bad. It is, of course, during this era that it's the kind of place that would ban every single stew, which we covered last issue. London regulated as much of the life in the city as they could get away with. And because of this, it's because we know these surprising details about the city found in the records, such as the Moorgate only being a postern gate. It's also how we discover about now just how wide the River Fleet was. We know that the river that ran from the Thames was wide enough to take two ships of 20 tons each. And these craft were bringing up stones to Holborn Bridge, which has been replaced by Holborn Viaduct. And we discover in these records the accounts of an inquest, of an event that took place in 1417, when a man called Thomas Frank of Harwich, who was a steersman on a ship called the Mary Knight that had sailed out of Poland, drowned in the Thames. Apparently the witnesses to the event describe how on, quote, the 5th day of August last past, between the 2nd and 3rd hour of the afternoon in that day, the ship aforesaid, by the negligence and undue steering of the steersmen and mariners therein, was sent and lodged upon a certain shelp called Ratstonbourne Shelp, unquote. Shelp here refers to a shelf or sandbank just below the surface of the river, and this one was well known enough to gain itself a name. And it was located, quote, near to West Greenwich, unquote. Apparently, having allowed themselves to run aground, quote, that they had let go off one of their anchors, the more speedily to get said ship off said shelp at the next flow of the tide, where then and there the said Thomas Frank went outside of the ship and stood upon another anchor which was hanging from the bow of the ship, and taking in his hands a certain staff called a speck, unquote, which is the name of a spike or handspike, quote, He thrust the staff into the knot of the rope by which the other anchor, which had been before let down, was fastened. And while with such staff he was exerting himself with all his might to loosen and let the rope aforesaid, the anchor, upon which he was standing, swayed so greatly to and fro that it turned over, upon which said Thomas fell into the water, striking his head in so falling against the iron peak and sharp end of that anchor, which penetrated through his forehead to the brain, unquote. A tragic accident showing how unglamorous some deaths could be at the time, and also that for all the regulations of London, health and safety was not one of them. It should be noted that in 1417, the mayor and the assembled aldermen decreed that during the upcoming Christmas celebrations, quote, it was ordered that proclamation should be made on the morrow that no one shall go at night with a visor or a false face. Also that there shall be no mummering during the feast of our Lord's Nativity, unquote. Yes, once again a rule banning the wearing of masks and false beards over Christmas, or holding mummers' plays during the same time. Ah yes, big party poopers. Why the sudden reissuing of this ban? Well, it wasn't a sudden ban, as I said, it had been banned before, but obviously the practice had restarted again. And we also read that added to this, quote, it was ordered that every alderman shall have sufficient guard in his ward during the same feast. Also that all the gates of the city should be closed every night at 9 o'clock and opened at 5 o'clock in the morning, unquote. The chances are it was the raucousness of Christmas celebrations and the wildness of Christmas parties that was causing this clampdown on wearing silly beards. See, it's not just our current era that the authorities of London seem to be going out of their way to try and ban any nightlife taking place. It's also noticing during the same period, they actually banned any officers of the mayor, the sheriffs and the chamber of taking any presents over Christmas. For example, quote, food, raiment and appropriate advantages resulting from their office, unquote. So it does seem like Christmas was a time of wild celebration and bribing the officers of the city to look the other way to let them hold the wild celebrations. Meanwhile, over the years 1418 and 1419, there was a separate political issue took place that had disastrous results. The issue of debtors' prisons. You see, if you owed money in the 15th century, you were arrested and jailed and kept in jail until the debt was cleared. But there was an issue. See, we read two very different edicts from the mayors of London about this situation. The first goes, quote, whereas the commendable intentions and charitable purposes of those who have been governors and presidents of the city of London hereto have ordained a prison, called Ludgate, for the good and comfort of poor freemen of the same city who had been condemned, to the end that such poor prisoners might, more freely, other than those who were strangers, dwell in quiet in such a place, and pray for their benefactors, and live upon the alms of the people, unquote. So, Ludgate was London's principal debtors' prison, a place where the poor and those who could not pay their debts would remain, and literally live off the charity of richer people and pray for someone rich to cover their debts. And ultimately, according to the mayor, quote, in such imprisonment, pass all their lives, if God should provide no other remedy for them, unquote. Like, there was no debt relief unless the person you owed the money wrote off those debts. And we know from previous chapters, there were cases of debt being written off, but it was quite rare. So this was the system in all its brutal simplicity. If you owed money, you were sentenced to live in Ludgate. However, the mayor complained, quote, a thing to be deplored, the charitable intentions and commendable purposes aforesaid are frustrated and turned to evil, insomuch as many false persons of bad disposition and purpose have been more willing to take up their abode there, so as to waste and spend their goods upon the ease and license that there is within, than to pay their debts, unquote. Yep, according to the mayor, some people were deciding that they're not going to pay their debts, but rather they're going to live life in Ludgate, and with their actual assets, maintain a decent lifestyle. Because depending on how much you were paying your jailer, you were allowed all the other liberties. And according to the mayor, this cushy lifestyle of these debtors got even worse. Quote, what is even more? Do their compass conspire and imagine oftentimes through others of their false coven to indict good, reputable and loyal men of the same city and of other districts for certain felonies and treasons, of which they have never been guilty, and whereby the said men are oftentimes in danger of being ruined in body and in goods, unquote. Now, while we can take this complaint of aldermen, who by their nature are more likely to be persons who extended credit to others, complaining about malingerers when it came to pay, and complaining about those who refuse to pay their debts but live kind of comfortably, and therefore they could be guilty of, well, exaggerating, they do mention specific cases of people who apparently were corrupted by these professional debtors. Quote, just as of late it befell when Roger Olvin and Roger Lawswell, with certain other prisoners, their accomplices in the said prison, caused to be indicted John Lane and John Gedney, who of late were sheriffs of the same city, Robert Arnold, William Borton, and certain others of the more substantial citizens of said city, with other persons, to be the number of 60 or more, unquote. So this was no small matter. Former sheriffs had apparently been taken in by these debtors in Ludgate Jail. Something needed to be done. And so, we then see this mayor, a man called William Sevenoak, quote, wishing to provide some special remedy on this behalf, so far as they may, considering that the foundations of this enormous crime was laid and commenced within the said prison of Ludgate, and that the liberty of the said prison is rather the cause and occasion of the non-payment of people than the payment, and so against that good policy in the cause of which every prison was first founded and ordained, that the said prison of Ludgate should be abolished and disqualified as a prison, and that all the prisoners therein shall be removed and safely carried to Newgate, there to remain, each in such keeping as his own deserts shall demand, unquote. Yep, they decided to close the debtors' jail of Ludgate and moved all the debtors into the criminal prison of Newgate. Understand, what was also happening was people in Ludgate didn't just live in Ludgate, they lived in the liberties around Ludgate. It may be if you owed money and you were condemned there, you had enough money to afford a room in a building next door or just down the street from Ludgate. That's the liberty. And you could reside there. And to the mayor, this luxurious lifestyle would be no more. To hell with these debtors. Stick them into Newgate. That would get them to pay, wouldn't it? Sounds like a great idea, but of course it wasn't. See, Newgate Prison was a hellhole, a fetid, dark and diseased place where real criminals were sent literally to rot. And as such, when Mayor Sevenoaks died and Richard Whittington was elected for his fourth term in the office of mayor, we read a new proclamation from the city, which says, quote, many persons who lately were in the said prison of Ludgate, and who in the time of William Sevenoak, late mayor, for divers great offences which they had there compressed, were committed to the said jail of Newgate, are now dead, who might have been living, it is said, if they'd remained in Ludgate abiding in peace there. And seeing that every person is sovereignly bound to support and to be tender of the lives of men, therefore Richard Whittington, now mayor, and the aldermen have ordained and established that the said gate of Ludgate should be a prison from henceforth, to keep therein all citizens and other reputable persons whom the mayor, aldermen, sheriffs and chamberlain of the city shall think proper to commit and send to the same. Unquote. Yeah, the debacle of sending debtors to Newgate lasted less than a year and was stopped because it was killing folks. Dying for the crime of owing someone some cash. This was actually even too harsh for old medieval London. So Ludgate was restored as a debtor's prison. Just goes to show, even in the Middle Ages, you could learn sometimes maybe we're being a bit harsh. 1419 had seen King Henry V build upon his victory in Agincourt and take Rouen after a siege, and our records tell us, quote, after toilsome siege and many assaults, he victoriously subdued the great city of Rouen, together with the country round about, the wretched Frenchmen not daring to stand against him, and the citizens redeeming their lives for £40,000 in gold, on which account in London were made solemn procession of triumph through the city, with dancing, by clergy and people from the shrine of St. Ethelwald to the shrine of St. Edward, not once only, but each Wednesday and Friday, unquote. Yep, they're basically the shrine of St. Erkenwald is in St. Paul's and the shrine of St. Thomas is in Westminster. And yeah, at least every Wednesday, Friday, and perhaps even a third time, a glorious procession of priests and citizens dance through the streets celebrating the victory of Rouen. And we arrive in 1420 and find a London that is lively, wild and busy, and enjoying a successful king. But whereas the world seems certain, across the waters in France, Henry V was entirely redrawing the framework for how this endless war was to proceed, and was about to basically win the war. And that's the thing. He did win the war. Briefly. And then, in less than 2 years, he was to be dead. And that was to turn everything upside down. Thanks for listening. A chapter that was just filled with lots of moments from London in this era. We're back again next week with another chapter in the story of London. Sorry for being a day late this week. We had a leak, believe it or not, and had to be dealt with. There you go. Landlords today, eh? All right, see you then. This is Saul saying bye.